The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning to you. This is Donal Kavanagh with you on the 9 till noon show today on till 12 noon. We have 3 hours of chat and commentary and your perspectives, your news and views. You can make contact with us by texting or WhatsApping 086 60 25000. You can call us on 074 91 25000, 0035 374 91 25000 if you're outside of the dialing area. You can also get in touch with us via social media. We're at Highland Radio on X. We're Highland Hub on Facebook. Comments at highlandradio.com if you prefer to use email. You can, of course, watch the show unfold on our YouTube channel and Facebook pages, Highland Radio Ireland on YouTube, and either Highland Radio or Highland Radio News and Sport on our Facebook pages. And you can watch the show unfold, watch our Zoom interviews, watch our in-studio guests as well. Because it's Wednesday, we will have the business news with Chris Ashmore later on in the programme. Also have our Wellness Wednesday spot. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. But as we always say, the most important part of this programme is you. So please do get in touch. Starting with a look at the papers, and we begin this morning with the Finn Valley Voice. The front page headline: Stinger Spike Device Stops Maniac Drivers Twice in One Weekend. Pat Holland writes that a police device called the Stinger Spike was used on both sides of the border. It was used to stop a driver who went on what's referred to as a vehicle rampage in the Letterkenny area. Later, a car that failed to stop for Gardaí on Lifford Bridge was stopped by a Stinger Spike by the PSNI near Oma. And that story is on the front of this morning's Finn Valley Voice. Looking to the Nationals, and again a front page story on the Irish Independent that refers what they're calling the land hoarding tax. That's the residential zoned land tax. Now, we spoke yesterday to Paul Canning about this, and this was a tax that was causing a lot of distress in Donegal, because it's a tax which is designed to prevent people sitting on development land and not releasing it until they can get an inflated price for that land, which is arguably fair enough. But the problem is that in areas like Donegal, the way the directions to the county planners works is that they are zoning some land as what they call opportunity land, which effectively means that land which is farmed and owned by farm families that have no intention of selling it is being zoned as opportunity land for potential development in the future. And that land was also falling under the purview of this tax. So a tax which is designed to prevent speculators from holding on to potentially important development land in order to drive up prices is actually penalising farmers who are working on their land, using the land to farm as they have done for, in some cases, generations. But they are now being forced, it would, if this was going through, they'd be forced to pay 3% tax on the value of that land on the basis that they are hoarding. And a lot of discussion about that over the past year in the Chamber of Donegal County Council. And as we now know, it's been deferred for a year. The Green Party fearful that this may effectively stop the tax going through altogether. We'll be watching closely to see what happens with that one. There's an interesting story inside the Independent. Anger over Road Safety Authority ad campaign branded ableist by TD. Now, this is the Green Party TD, Nessa Hourigan, who is taking exception to the Lose Your Licence, Lose Your Independence campaign. Now, this new ad, which has been released by the RSA as part of the campaign, it shows a man who is a disqualified driver being carried by friends and family. And the purpose of the ad is to show that the person that loses their licence can become reliant on those around them. Now, Nessa Hourigan is concerned that this may be ableist and be making a comment on those who are perhaps disabled and have conditions. Now, in many cases, of course, people who are disabled and in wheelchairs are perfectly able to drive, and they are perfectly able to use a car and use facilities. But also concern about it being expressed by cyclists and by people who choose not to drive, effectively saying, are you saying that someone who isn't able to drive is a burden on their friends and family? Now, I mean, there's an argument that says effectively what the ad is doing is it's targeting people who are committed to driving, and it's saying to those people, if you can't drive, and it's playing on their perceptions and playing on their fears. It's an interesting one, and I'd be very interested to hear your take on that particular ad. Is it a clever and novel way of making a point to drivers and making them think about their behaviour and making them think about the potential consequences of them being banned? Or is it effectively ableist and a commentary which could be seen as insulting to sections of our population, both in terms of those with disabilities and perhaps even more so in terms of those who choose not to drive, have chosen not to drive, and might be perceived under the terms of that advert as being burdens on their friends and family? And is that the case? It's an interesting one. Irish Daily Mail this morning. Spice Girl MC's ancestors fled the famine, we're told, on page 3. Mel C has revealed that she broke down in tears as she discovered her family's heartbreaking battle to survive the famine in Ireland before they rose up through the ranks as political activists. The Spice Girl 50... A Spice Girl 50, wow. Explored her history for next week's episode of Who Do You Think You Are on BBC One. And she said some of what she learned about her family's experiences in County Limerick, where they were based before fleeing to Liverpool. And anyone who's been to Liverpool will know that there's a huge Irish contingent in Liverpool. Very much Liverpool is a city that was built and fashioned and forged by its proximity to both Dublin and Belfast. And the influences of both are clearly visible in that wonderful city. Also on page 3 of the Irish Daily Mail this morning, Kiwi dancing queen Kiri takes the crown in New Zealand's first Rose win since 1998. Now, actually, I thought it was 1988, she said, but no, however, I thought, I'll be honest, I treated Rose of Tralee last night. My better half and daughter watched quite a bit of it. I was inside in the kitchen watching travel videos on YouTube, and I went in for the last 5 minutes to see who won. That's being bluntly honest, which is the way I treat the Rose of Tralee every year, to be perfectly frank. I hear that the Donegal Rose acquitted herself very well, as indeed did the Derry Rose, and both were up there in the running when my better half was speculating about who could win. Both the Derry and Donegal entrants were both noted as potential winners, but it went to New Zealand, and that's going to be an interesting one. I know the outgoing Rose is from New York, and they were saying she was over and back across the Atlantic something like 15 or 16 times over the course of the past year. It'll be interesting to see what happens now in the case of Kiri. How often will she be travelling from New Zealand over to Ireland? Irish Times this morning. Israeli arms companies can bid for Irish drones contract. Israeli companies well positioned to win a €600,000 contract, according to military sources. Ireland has paid, we're told, more than €8.5 million to Israeli arms manufacturers in the past decade. The full story is there. And the Irish Defence Forces say there are no restrictions on Israeli companies making such bids. Now, I know any government body in Ireland must follow EU rules and regulations when it comes to tenders and contracts. And presumably, if there is to be a discussion on whether Israeli companies should be allowed tender for such contracts, that's a discussion that's going to have to be had at EU level as well as national level. And I'm sure that discussion is being had. And I know there are certainly a number of Irish MEPs would be pushing that line very strongly, I'm sure. Proportion of students at private schools declines, we're told on the Irish Times. The proportion of students attending fee-paying schools are declining. According to latest figures published by the Department of Education, the expansion of new school places in the free education sector is in response to record numbers of school children at second level. That's a story in this morning's Irish Times. Looking at the red top tablets this morning, a lot of coverage still about the hunt for the trapped bodies in the super yacht tragedy, that yacht that sank off the coast of Sicily earlier this week. Inside the paper, Harris to tackle holiday hunger. Taoiseach pledges support for families in budget. Simon Harris wants to examine how children can be provided with hot school meals outside of term time to address the issue of holiday hunger. He was speaking at an event in Dublin yesterday, which focused on parents and working families. And we did hear discussion of this indeed before the school holidays this year, where people were pointing out there are a lot of children who are now in the position where the only hot meal they'll get in the day is the hot meal they'll get in school. And concern being expressed that when you have a summer holiday, that's anything from 6 weeks to 12, 13 weeks, depending on whether you're doing exams or whether you're in primary, secondary school or whatever, that in cases many young children are not getting hot meals over the course of the summer. So that's something that Taoiseach is promising to look into, and we'll be looking at that one, no doubt, with interest. Now, there is a picture on the front of the Irish Sun. Scandal of scoliosis, children. Simon Harris announced yesterday that Fine Gael is delivering for families, but that's not true for kids who are awaiting scoliosis surgery. There's a picture of Simon Harris standing under a sign that says, best start in life for every child. But then the banner headline goes, dot, 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 not for sick kids. Promises galore, but little action, according to the headline there. Inside the paper, Biden bids farewell. And this is a story covered in a number of papers this morning as well, obviously. An emotional Joe Biden has formally passed the baton to Kamala Harris, clearing the way for her to run for the White House. The move came as the US president received a standing ovation at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. He said Kamala Harris was on course to be a historic president. First Lady Jill Biden told the convention that her husband had dug deep into his soul before pulling out of the presidential race. And also inside the Irish Sun this morning, Madonna. My fans are fat and spotty. A 90s interview that was carried out with Madonna has landed her in hot water because she said her fans were fat, spotty and horrible to look at. I don't mind when people come up to me in a restaurant and go, God, I think you're great. I think that it's the obsessive fanatics whose attention seems very hostile. It's beyond admiration. It's very crazy. It's always fat people too. And now, yet another example of something someone said in the 1990s or several years ago when they were young and foolish coming back to haunt them. Finally, Irish Daily Star this morning. Is Hart the man to save Offaly? This is the question on the front of the paper. And it's pointing out that Mickey Hart is about to go down to the Midlands. And he's been appointed in Offaly. The barbers have been quick enough, we're told by Carlo Kane in a comment. One barber that he's passed his sell-by date, another is fear of defensive football, and they go on. Offaly need only glance at where Louth have come from and moved on to, and they'll see Mickey Hart's fingerprints all over it. So Mickey Hart going down to Louth, what impact is that going to have on... Now, that's interesting, because that's going to put Mickey Hart now in the same provincial championships as Dublin and... Meath, and you know, the Leinster football championship has always been characterised as basically Dublin year after year after year. It's Dublin and a couple of other counties. So can Mickey Hart shake that one up a bit, or is Mickey Hart a one trick pony? And we'll have more discussions, I have no doubt about that, over the course of the coming season. It's the 9th of Noon Show on Highland Radio, 17 minutes past 9 on Wednesday morning, the 21st of August. We're going to take a short break back after these. And a very good morning, and you're welcome back to the 9 till Noon Show on this Wednesday morning. If you were reading your Irish Times at the weekend, you may well have seen an article, Northern Ireland is in its terminal phase. This place never made any ethical or economic sense. With the subhead underneath, there is hope now that the natural patterns of society and economics will revive and a century of waste in Derry will be swept away. The author of that article was Neil Hegarty, and Neil joins us on Zoom. Neil, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. Great to be here.
Thank you very much indeed. Neil, first of all, put this into context for us. Tell us where you're coming from as the author of this, and we'll take the conversation from there.
I'm from Derry, so you can probably tell from my accent. I've lived in Dublin now for 30 odd years. I came down to go to university here and I more or less stayed, but I'm, you know, still a Derry man, up and down that awful road all the time. My parents are still there and I also have strong Donegal connections as well in Isshuan. And I was coming from the angle that if you look around Derry, I started my article for the Irish Times on the city walls from a kind of almost a tourist's point of view, looking around the place, seeing how lovely it is, aware of the history of the place, the river, the Donegal Hills in the background and so on. But I couldn't help but be aware of the fact that the city is looking fairly ramshackle these days. I know that its economy is not in good shape. Its infrastructure is not in great shape. Its links to the rest of the world, as you and Donegal know as well, is not in good shape either. And that this is the way it has been for such a long time. And it's inextricably linked to Derry's place in Northern Ireland itself. And what I wanted to do was to was to kind of illustrate all those facts to a more southern audience. Mm. Obviously, I don't mean a Donegal audience here, but to a lot of people further south in Ireland who maybe don't have the awareness of what life is like in the Northwest in the same kind of way. And the response, I must say, has been amazing.
Yeah. Now, the counter-argument to what you're saying, and, I mean, you even talked about that awful road. Now, I moved from Waterford to Donegal in 1990, which is it's 34 years ago next month that I moved up here. Now, I mean, the road, certainly driving from Letterkenny to Dublin and then on to Waterford, that road has improved so much over the course of the past 30 years. There's basically... Going to Waterford, there's about 2 hours taken off the journey because of motorways, dual carriageways, bypasses, etc. Yeah. There was a time you had to go through about 20 towns and villages on the way to Dublin. Yeah. Now the last urban area you pass through is Emmyvale, and then it's dual carriageway motorway on from RD on. Now, so there's improvements there. If you're in Derry, the road to Belfast, I mean, the improvements over the past even 5 or 6 years heading for Belfast, that road has improved an awful lot. So the argument is, it's getting better. That certainly where it was 30 years ago, infrastructure-wise, it's better. In terms of the development within the city, there's more employment. Now, there is, I mean, you know, to take an old Fianna Fáil slogan from about what Bertie's last election, I think it was, when their slogan was, a lot done, more to do. And that's a something that could be sort of put on Derry at the moment. I mean, the powers that be in Stormont and Westminster will argue, yeah, you've got a point, but we're on our way.
I would say that there is something in that. If you take the issue of the road, yes, from Emmyvale to Waterford, you can sweep along pretty fast from Emmyvale to Derry, Emmyvale to Derry and on, and then from Strabane to Letterkenny. Yeah. It's as bad as it's ever been, and it's a death trap. And even though everybody keeps saying, yes, we're going to start work on this road soon, yeah, it's going to be soon. In the meantime, there are scores of people dying.
Yeah,
on
But I mean, as I always said to people when it comes to the A5, when I started driving to Waterford, the best part of the journey was the A5. When I was driving to Waterford, that was the best part of the journey. Now, with the exception of Letterkenny Lifford, it's the worst.
It's the worst. It's the worst. And people are killed all the time. The Belfast Road, you're absolutely right. The Dungiven bypass has improved things hugely, but it's still not a dual carriageway all the way. And this again is after years and years, and there's no sense of when it will be a dual carriageway all the way. The rail service is still not great, and they simply won't release the funds which will make it as good as it could be and should be for one of the busiest lines in the north.
They have been talking, I think it's 2027, they're talking about closing that line for a couple of months and actually doing what's been demanded for so long, and that's having a double track right from Coleraine into Derry.
Yes, but in the meantime, it's interesting to look at what's happening in Belfast at the same time. The Enterprise service from Belfast to Dublin is much less used than the Belfast to Derry line, and yet it's in line now for hundreds of millions of investment, and it just gets it like that, in the same way as Belfast's new campus of Ulster University got its hundreds of millions just like that, whereas Derry has to wait and wait and beg for what seems like scraps quite a lot of the time. And that's the fundamental sense that the vision that you see happening for Belfast is very, very limited in scale when it's applied to Derry. You get little bits and then everybody says, right, okay, that's grand. Now you can stop whinging.
There's a lot of focus, speaking about the university, there's a lot of focus on the medical school in Derry, and a lot of good work's been done there. Have we got to a point where some of us are allowing the welcome for the medical school maybe blind us to the fact that in other areas of that university, the progress isn't as comprehensive and quick as it should be?
Yeah, I've put a lot of thought into the whole position of Ulster University in the city, and even though I only talk about it a little bit in the Irish Times piece, it was that element which got so much attention in Ireland and Britain, and frankly all over the place. I was getting messages from all over the world saying this is exactly it. The point that I was making is that it's not right, it shouldn't be right that Derry has to settle for being a satellite campus to a Belfast-based and overwhelmingly Belfast-focused university. The medical school has come years late. It came in the teeth of the most bitter political opposition from unionist politicians at Stormont. But here's the point. There's nothing that would stop a Belfast-based university from, as it's done so many times in the past, moving courses back to Belfast if it's in its, if it makes financial sense for Ulster University to do that. The point that I'm making is that if we had an independent university in the Northwest, in Derry and in Letterkenny, of course, crucially, then that university would have its roots sunken in the city, in the region. It would be absolutely committed to developing itself there in Derry and in Letterkenny. And it wouldn't be glancing over its shoulder the whole time of what's happening in Belfast. And also, and I just want to make this, this is a very important point. Ulster University has been, I think, plenty of evidence for this. Ulster University has been delinquent in its stewardship of McGee for decades. It has promised the earth and delivered very, very little. And even now, when there are developments happening on the McGee campus, the division thing, as Bill Clinton would have said, is so limited. It's like, oh yes, maybe we get to 10,000 students by 2030, or maybe it'll be after that. And my sense is that, is this what we have to be satisfied with? 10,000 students, which is frankly not that many, in a campus which is only ever going to be an adjunct to a Belfast university. The vision thing is still completely lacking, in spite of medical school and everything else that they keep trumpeting as being some sort of amazing breakthrough, when in fact, frankly, it isn't really.
You're speaking about UU's in Derry and the McGee links with Letterkenny. As we know, a memorandum of understanding was signed between UU in Derry and the ATU in the Republic in January. As it happens, by coincidence, the Further Education Minister at the time was, of course, Simon Harris, who is now the Taoiseach. I did happen to be there at the campus in Letterkenny when it was signed, and he was there to oversee it. The interesting thing is that links Ulster University in Derry, not only with Letterkenny, it also links it with Mayo, links it with Sligo, links it with Galway. So you've got, not only have you links going east to Belfast, you've got very strong potential links now going west to Donegal and sort of southwest down toward Galway, down toward Mayo, down toward Sligo. Is there more potential for those links to be made stronger and more beneficial to the city? Or has Brexit and the political deepening of the political gap between the two, has that sort of potentially stymied those chances?
Well, Derry, as you know, of course, Donal has always looked west.
Oh, yeah.
Has always looked at Donegal, has always looked outwards, and has never really looked east. That's never been its natural orientation. So it's been locked into this, I think, kind of weird symbiotic relationship with
the
Belfast.
City region, as we call it, yeah.
Yeah, which works for Belfast and doesn't work at all for Derry and never has. And interestingly, Simon Harris is on record, very emphatically on record, as saying that he is very interested in the idea of an independent university in the Northwest. He said it's, you know, it should be called the John Hume University. I think the name is immaterial at this point, but I was pleased with that statement from him a couple of years ago. And then in the meantime, of course, the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin has done a lot of work on this issue and has produced a lot of facts, a lot of figures which back up the idea that an independent university in Derry and the Northwest would be so enormously beneficial in economic terms. I would add to that in social terms too. If you're a family in Derry or in Donegal or the Northwest, and you're thinking of your kids going to university, how much easier in financial terms and practical terms would it be if you could rely on the fact that there's a full-scale university in your region? You don't have to pack your kids off on the bus to Galway or to Belfast. It would make so much financial sense. It would be better for families, better for the kind of local community, if they could rely on their kids being closer to home, if that's what they wanted. And of course, you make a really good point that in the longer term, I mean, I say in my piece, look, I think Northern Ireland probably doesn't have that much longer to go. That's obviously controversial. Lots of people are going to say, no, you're absolutely wrong. But the establishment of stronger and stronger finance, economic links to the West and to the Southwest, it is part of that, of what I take to be that movement to disengage Derry, a kind of necessary disengagement from a economic unit which has never worked for it, and outwards into a kind of a wider world. And that's a way to turn the economic corner in Derry, which so badly needs to be turned.
The final question is a question that will take years to answer. But as you say, you do believe that Northern Ireland, as it currently stands, is in its terminal phase. That's as included in the headline. But it's not just simply a matter of subsuming Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland as it stands, creating an extra 18 or 20 seats in Dáil Éireann and just having a Foyle constituency sitting at Leinster House. It ain't going to be that simple. We saw how messy the Brexit negotiations were and how long that took. That would be nothing compared to the discussions, I suspect, that would be centred around what we will call, for the sake of argument, a United Ireland. This is not going to be a quick process.
This is definitely not going to be a quick process, and nobody should be naive about it. I've always thought that it isn't a question of trying to fold Northern Ireland into the Republic. We can see how difficult and how kind of damaging in a way that was for Germany. And in the Irish context, the two parts of Ireland are too closely balanced in terms of population and so on. I think, and I think that this is a way to, if you like, to sell it, to market it, is to say, look, this would be the most fantastic chance to take the best of both sides and to create an even stronger state, which with health systems and education systems, elder care systems, which really, really work. It's a chance to redesign a new state, which works for everybody and that nobody has to be afraid of. And it's about that very, very optimistic, very positive message that people can really get behind, so that it doesn't become about the politics of, you know, of fear and foreboding.
The problem is, does it become a future-looking dialogue about the potential of taking the best of both worlds, or does it take a backward-looking, historical-focused orange versus green?
I think if you get into the stuff of people's lives, and also that means the stuff of the money in their pockets, and say, this will float your own boat higher. This will make your family and your society better off in the medium term, in the long term. It doesn't have to be about orange versus green or any of the things in the past. Let's think about all these new structures and shapes which we can design together for the future. And that's not, that isn't a form of kind of idealism. That's very, very, it's highly practical, I would say. That's something that everybody can get stuck into, roll their sleeves up about.
There are some very interesting discussions ahead, and I've no doubt this article will help to spark them. Neil, very interesting reading. Anyone who wishes can look back at the weekend edition of the Irish Times. But for now, Neil Hegarty, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on.
This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Caller says, just heard about crowbangers on the news there. Could that be the loud regular bang over Loch Swilly that has the whole town talking and keeping some people awake at night? It seems to be happening more regularly over the past week, perhaps every 5 minutes for a lengthy period of time, then it disappears. Caller, I can tell you that a crowbanger, I suspect it is, because it's Buncrana the story is focused on. Michaela and Don Murray have been speaking to Councillor Jack Murray. If you go to our website, highlandradio.com, the full story is up there with a lengthy interview with Councillor Murray on it. It may well be on the news at 10 o'clock as well, but certainly it seems to me, caller, from reading your comment, that yes, that is the same story that we were speaking to Councillor Jack Murray about, and if you go to the website, you'll be able to hear that story in full, and it'll be broadcast, of course, on the full interview will be on the news at 1, and there'll be other discussion about it during the day as well. Now, let's look at the Clear Our Paths campaign. It's a campaign every year to try and get people not to park on paths, not to put sandwich boards on footpaths that potentially can impact on people whose vision is impaired. If the Clear Our Paths campaign worked, we're told, it wouldn't be needed every year. However, it still is necessary. Kevin Kelly is the head of external affairs with Vision Ireland, and Kevin joins us on Zoom. Kevin, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Joe Donald. Delighted to be on air again.
Thank you very much indeed. Kevin, clear our paths. And the point is a very fair one. I mean, it's a campaign that takes place every year. Your argument is, really, it shouldn't have to take place every year.
Ideally, we would prefer that we didn't have to run our annual Clear Our Paths campaign, but from talking to people who use Vision Ireland's services, it's very clear that we need to continue raising the profile of this particular issue, because people who are blind and vision impaired, or people with reduced mobility or other disabilities, are encountering these obstacles on a daily basis. You mentioned in your introduction there some of the obstacles that people encounter, ranging from wheelie bins to parked cars to bikes and e-scooters not being parked appropriately, in some cases just abandoned in the middle of the path. Branches and hedges not being trimmed back, which present an issue with people getting cuts and gashes to their face. We also have the very unpleasant business of dog owners not picking up after their dogs, which both presents a safety and a health disease control issue for people who are blind and vision impaired as they step into the dog poo itself. Obviously, they could potentially slip on it, but it gets onto the bottom of their mobility device, most commonly a long cane with a roller tip, and then they're faced with the very unpleasant task of having to clean that up. So we're calling on the general public and dog owners in particular to act more responsibly and think about the needs of people who are blind and vision impaired, and in fact people with reduced mobility generally.
The really concerning statistic is that over the course of the past 12 months, and there was a similar campaign last year, there's been a 37% increase in reports of injuries caused by obstacles on footpaths.
Yes, that was quite stark in our research study. We run this campaign every August, and some of those injuries range from cuts and gashes to the face, as I described, from overhanging branches. But we had reports of multiple sprained ankles and even two broken ankles, and a very unfortunate case where a manhole cover had been removed outside a property and hadn't been replaced. And unfortunately, someone who was vision impaired fell into that manhole, and that could have been quite serious, but they did require medical intervention. So all of those things are avoidable if people are more responsible.
The point you're making is this is not just a safety issue anymore. This is an issue of rights.
Absolutely. People who are blind and vision impaired need to be afforded the same rights as everyone else, and people's safety is being jeopardized on a daily basis. And I'm sure some of your listeners will have, you know, popped to the local shop. Oh, sure, I'll just park here. I'm only going to be 2 minutes. It's wet. But in reality, it's often not 2 minutes. It can be five. 5 minutes becomes 10 because you meet someone, you're having a conversation. But in that period of time, you're hampering someone else potentially from being able to complete their journey and go about their business. And the issue of parked cars on paths is quite a serious one. Last year, nationally, 22,000 parking fines were issued, which just shows you the seriousness of the problem. And that's only the violations that have been detected in Donegal. Information released to Vision Ireland by Donegal County Council was that 533 had been issued, with 412 fines having been successfully paid. So it is very much an issue in Donegal. It's an issue in every county. And when someone who's blind and vision impaired encounters a parked car on a footpath, they either have to wait for the driver to return, or they're faced with the prospect of having often to step off the footpath into oncoming traffic, which makes them very vulnerable. There's a chance that, again, that they might slip or fall. The motorist may not be expecting someone to step out at that particular point because it's not a recognised crossing point. So the action of, you know, parking a car on a path can have a very serious impact on people who are blind and vision impaired, or people who use wheelchairs and other mobility devices, and even mothers and fathers who are out and about with prams and pushchairs. It presents them a challenge as well.
And the point's been made in the past that some motorists seem to regard the hazard lights on a car as a license to park on a footpath, and it's okay, as you say, I'll just be 2 minutes, I just need to nip in here to do something really, really important. But the fact is, someone with a visual impairment may not see those flashing lights and may walk straight into that car. That the flashing lights is no excuse, and certainly the flashing lights issues no license or issues no right to park there.
I couldn't put it better myself, Donal, and you know I'm blind myself. I'm no longer living in the county. I'm now living in Dublin, but this is a nationwide problem. I encounter all of these problems that we've been discussing on a daily basis, and for people who are blind and vision impaired, and particularly for people who maybe have acquired their sight loss later in life, one of the most difficult things that you'll do when you lose your sight is to build up your confidence to be able to travel safely outdoors using a long cane or a guide dog. And all of these experiences, these obstacles, have a very negative impact on someone's psychology, and it may often result in them not wanting to go out and be totally independent. And then that leads to all of the other problems around social isolation, which are well documented and I would have discussed previously on the programme.
Kevin, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Hopefully this has made people think about what they do when they're parking and when they're on the roads. And as we say, everything from sandwich boards and dog poo and so on, it's a potential hazard on the footpath. I have to say, something I hadn't thought about all that much was the idea of the overhanging bushes, the overhanging trees and so on and so forth. And it's a very important reminder to me in particular and to others that, yes, it's not just what's on the footpath is the issue. It's what can be 3, 4, 5 feet over the footpath. And arguably, that's even more dangerous in some senses because, you know, you might, with a cane or with a dog, you might be aware of the obstacles on the footpath because it'll be detected by a cane, detected by the dog or whatever. The overhanging branches, not so clearly, and they are a huge danger, which, to be honest, from my own point of view, and they say you learn something new every day, that's something I had never thought about.
Yes, it does result in kind of very nasty cuts and gashes to the face, and ironically enough, cuts and scrapes to the eyeball itself, which could jeopardize someone's sight even further if they had some partial sight. So I would encourage all property owners today, if their hedge overhangs a public footpath, that they should go out and trim it back. And again, this is not, you know, about lecturing people about, you know, big brothers watching you. This is about, you know, doing something good, taking social responsibility, and it will benefit everyone living in the county.
Kevin Kelly, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Donald.
Kevin, you take care, and we'll be back after these. There are blood transfusion service clinics in Ballybuffet. Just to give you the times, today, Wednesday, from 3 until 10 past 5, and again from 7 until 20 to 10 this evening, and tomorrow from 12 noon until 2, and again from 4 until 20 to 8. That's at Jackson's Hotel in Ballybuffet. They're the times for the blood transfusion service clinics, and as always, the blood transfusion service appealing to anyone who can to come forward and donate blood, because it's a very, very important thing to do. Now, we're going to talk about retirement, and specifically, we're going to talk about planning for retirement, and with a focus on what should your relationship be with your former colleagues. In some places, people will retire and they'll call in for a regular chat at work. In other cases, people will retire, they'll shake the dust off the soles of their shoes, walk into the sunset, never to turn back. On Zoom, we're joined by Paul Kenny, who is Programme Leader with the Retirement Planning Council. Paul, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Don.
Paul, I suppose there's as many approaches to this as there are people, but you've been looking at the issue of friendships and relationships during retirement, particularly in terms of former work colleagues.
Yeah, the thing is that a lot of people feel that they'll be able to maintain their current friendships, their current work-based friendships when they retire. And it's a lovely aspiration to have and all of that. But, you know, things change when you retire. And one of the phenomena is that the people who are still working don't have the same time that you have. You're there 24/7, 365, and they're not. They're still noses to the grindstone, so they don't have the time to drop out for a cup of coffee or whatever. But I think there's a lot of different dynamics going on here because, for example, if you live in a rural area and you're working fairly close to home, you're embedded in the community and the community friendships that are there, the contacts that you have and so on, they're not going to change very much. On the other hand, if you live in a rural community and you have a long commute to work in a town, then, you know, you may have lost some of your contacts with your roots, if you like, in the local community, and you've got to try and re-establish those as well. If you live on one side of a town and your friend from work lives on the far side of the town, another 50-minute commute away, it's harder to keep in touch.
I remember my late father. My late father worked with, he started working with the P&T, which you remember well, I suspect, as I do. And then he was in the telephone section, so it then became Telecom Air, and then it became Telecom, then it became Aircom. He retired just before it became Air, and broadband was taking over. But he was there right from, and I remember him with the orange and white van climbing up poles, and it finished off. He was a senior manager. But he,
and when you had to turn a handle to get through on the phone.
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I remember those days well. But I remember him telling me that his immediate boss had retired a couple of years before him. And he told me that this guy, every Friday without fail, would call into the office for a cup of tea at 11 and would proceed to sit there for half an hour and tell the lads whatever they were working on. He would tell them how he would have done it. And he said it was lovely to see him for a while, but after 10 or 15 minutes, it was like, Christy, would you go home for God's sake?
Yes, and you're hearing all the same old stuff every time he comes in.
Oh, of course. I know it was different in my day.
Yeah, I know it is. It is difficult. There's no doubt about that. You know, it's not just the work colleagues. I mean, certainly we had a man who came up from Cork to Dublin for a pre-retirement course recently, and he heard someone boarding a train halfway to Dublin, and he recognised the voice of a former colleague, and he went down to talk to him, and he said, "How are you getting on, Joe?" And Joe said, "To tell you the truth," he said, "I don't know how I had time to work." Mm. So he had engaged in so many activities after retirement and met new people through those activities. And that's one of the things that happens, that it's what you do that brings you into contact with new people.
And I know we have a very busy active retirement group up here in Donegal, and I have to give a plug to people like Grania Hines and her colleagues in the active retirement group, because they do great work. And I mean, I know there's people out there can't wait to retire just so they can get involved with this.
No, absolutely. The retired people's groups are fantastic, and also things like men's sheds and women's sheds now are becoming a phenomenon. You know, there are lots of ways of keeping in touch, but it's the activities that you engage in, and one of those things is that you might just resume things rather than taking up new things. There are hobbies that people had to give up because they simply ran out of time and they would like to get back into the things that they were interested in back in the day. But the other aspect of retirement and your friendships and your contacts is family.
Yeah.
And family are very, very important. And, you know, a lot of us lose touch with family members. And I suspect that you, along with the rest of us in Ireland, have the experience of going to the family funeral and meeting the people that you haven't met since the last funeral and vowed to keep up with on both sides to everybody's embarrassment.
I could name at least six cousins I'm in exactly that situation with.
Exactly. So that's one of the things that we have to do to value the family that we have and to make sure that we keep those lines open. And one of the great things you can do actually with that is start the family tree if you haven't already started it, because it's a great excuse for ringing someone up out of the blue and saying, "Can you help me? I'm stuck. The great granny is eluding me here, and you might be able to help." And people produce all kinds of things, mementos, photographs and so on, and they're delighted to get in on the act and find out a little bit more about their family too.
Important that people adjust, because I've heard stories, and I'm sure you've heard these stories too, about spouses who would have had a regimented life, and perhaps one partner stayed at home and the other went out to work, perhaps both went out to work. Then suddenly they're both at home at the same time. and they're both looking at each other, and within 6 months they're both driving each other up the walls. Important, yeah. Important that that's planned for and that those potential pitfalls are realised.
COVID-19 lockdown was a great preparation for some people into the phenomenon of sharing space. And if you are sharing space with someone, it's very important to realise that they have a life. And, you know, what I call the space invader has to be terribly careful. Because if there's somebody in occupation in the kitchen and you're coming in and you've got your ideas, but they've been used to their ideas all the time, and they've been in command of the kitchen, and suddenly you're the space invader. And it's really important to recognize that all the aspects of their life may not be an open book as far as you're concerned. Like the man who discovered that, he knew his wife was in a book club, but he didn't know the book club met in his house on a Thursday. Mm. That was a bit of a shock to him.
Paul, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and it's a very important issue, and the results of the survey are there. If very, very briefly, if people do want to see the results of the survey, how can they get to them?
Oh, it's on our website, rpc.ie. There's a lot of information there about the things that we do as well and the courses that we offer and so on. Mm. So please do. It's www.rpc.ie.
Paul Kenny, Programme Leader with the Retirement Planning Council. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Food for thought for those of us who perhaps are getting close to retirement, and making sure that we get a happy and healthy life after it. Paul, thank you.